Yes, yeah, so I'll be, you can see the title of my talk here is Philippe Reddit. This is based off a paper, a preprint of the same title. And this work has been done with Bill Wooters at Williams College. I have a discrete Wigner function plot here. These objects will play an important part in my talk today. And yep, you may have noticed there's a lot of William here for one slide, but I prefer to be called Billy. So, and I'm happy to take questions during the talk as we go. So here's an overview. When starting this project, our initial goal was kind of trotting along this popular path of trying to express quantum theory in terms of phase-based probability distributions. And what we've actually achieved is a formulation of quantum theory in terms of phase-based probability distributions for prime power dimensions. The main message of my talk is that there exists a way to combine the predictions of epistemically restricted observers to reproduce quantum predictions. And I'll be explaining what this all means. And this is the main equation that we use. So ignoring the delta for a moment, this is just the quantum mechanical probability of some event occurring, given that you prepared some state rho and subjected it to some transformation script E. And the delta is just the difference between this probability, means that you take the difference between this probability and the uniform distribution. And so I'm going to be explaining how we can recover this as a sum over many different classical frameworks, as we call them. And that's what the F stands for. And these are all legal probability distributions that one might think of an epistemically restricted observer as having. So my talk will basically be explaining how I arrive at this equation. Here's an outline. I'll start off by giving some motivation and discussing epistemically restricted theories. Then I'll move on to discrete phase space and discrete Wigner functions, which, as I mentioned, play an important role in the development. And then I'll discuss how quantum theory can be described completely quasi-probabilistically in terms of these discrete Wigner functions. They are quasi-probability distributions. So we can capture states, channels, and measurements using related objects. Then I'll move on to classical frameworks. I'll introduce this idea and how they connect to epistemically restricted states. And in this section, we'll borrow some tools from tomography. And then we'll show how quantum theory can be recovered as a collection of these epistemically restricted objects from these epistemically restricted theories. And I'll finish with some conclusions. So above the line is just going to be review of what has been known and to build up to what comes after the line, which will be our contribution to the discussion. So for motivation, do quantum states represent physical reality or an agent's knowledge of physical reality? This is a fundamental question in quantum foundations and one that I'm interested in. We can rephrase this to say, are quantum states ontic or epistemic objects? I'm not sure what the, I want to make this talk accessible to as many people as possible in the seminar. So just if you are not familiar with these words, ontic means pertaining to physical reality, and epistemic you can think of as meaning pertaining to knowledge of what is actually going on. So Rob Speckens and collaborators have developed a number of theories that demonstrate how a classical ontological theory subject to an epistemic restriction or an epistemic constraint can reproduce substantial aspects of quantum theory. So here are a few important papers. In the first one, Rob Speckens introduces a toy model that reproduces a classical theory that reproduces a lot of the phenomena one might associate with a quantum qubit. And there is an epistemic constraint that grows from a principle that is the knowledge balance principle. And it can be understood as saying if you have some set of ontic states that describe reality of your system, you can only know the answer to half of the questions that could possibly allow you to locate which ontic state your system is actually in. So it's not important that you remember that exact statement. It's just important to give a flavor of what these kind of epistemic constraints look like. And then these were, this idea was then developed for continuous systems in the second paper. And this third paper gives a unified approach with an epistemic constraint applicable to both discrete and continuous systems. And we'll mostly be focused on the principle found in this paper. So how do these epistemically restricted classical theories work? So here's a sketch of the idea. You start with a classical ontological theory that describes the kinematics and dynamics. So you could have picture some phase space where the ontic states are all described by giving a position and a momentum in the space. Epistemic states are then classical statistical distributions over the ontic states. And so here I've drawn a picture of a line. You could think of an epistemic state as being a uniform distribution over this line in phase space. All these states are equally probable. And then you need to specify a criteria that determines the form of the legal epistemic states. So what is knowable due to some principle? And the principle that we'll be leading towards is that the only things that are knowable are some linear combination of position and momentum. So this line could be an epistemic state that is that conforms the idea that there's some valuation here along this line that all these ontic states have, but you don't know which one corresponds to that value. So why are these restricted classical theories so interesting? So here I've taken a table from this paper again. And in the left-hand column, we find many phenomena that actually can be found in these epistemically restricted theories. But you know, these are all things that you would maybe say, oh, these are a really good signature of quantum behavior, non-classical behavior. But these can be found in these epistemically restricted theories. And there's a smaller list of things in the right-hand column of phenomena that cannot be found in these theories. So the non-locality and contextuality are two such features that these theories cannot capture. They're fundamentally non-contextual hidden variable models. So you can't get these features. So the question that we're trying to tackle is there a mathematical way to get from these epistemically restricted classical theories to quantum theory? And so we want to understand mathematically what lies between these theories and quantum theory, full quantum theory, and maybe gain some insight into a way that a principle might bridge a gap or find something that would obstruct a principle from bridging this gap from these epistemically restricted theories to full quantum theory. So I think this is, in my understanding, Rob was initially trying to motivate developments that were mathematical by starting with some principle. So you start with this epistemic constraint, and that leads to all these interesting phenomena. So we're kind of focusing more on the mathematical side here. I already showed this slide to you, but I just want to point out that this sort of idea can also be applied for systems with discrete degrees of freedom, not continuous ones. So I've changed our phase space to this one with many discrete points. And this could be a phase space that's associated with a discrete system with seven different states you could think of as positions. And for this sort of a system, we'll just ascribe a phase space with d squared or 7 squared different ontic states. And here I've just drawn the solution to this linear equation by circling a few points in red. This is a line in the space. So this is one way you can generalize or go from, this is the analog of the continuous in the discrete case. And so I just want to describe why this is a good analog. Are there good reasons to use this set for the ontic states for discrete classical systems? This is the question I want to answer in the next slide. And just parenthetically, I'll note that I'm going to be focusing on systems with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces in this talk. And eventually I'll restrict that to prime. So, So why, what are the good reasons for using this set of ontic states? So you can represent quantum states with Wigner functions. These are quasi-probability distributions. I'm going to be discussing these more later. And they exist for discrete and continuous systems. So here are two examples of Wigner functions. They can take negative values. Here's one that just looks like a line in the space. And for the stabilizer subtheory of quantum mechanics, Wigner functions can be used as a hidden variable model. So for this subtheory of quantum mechanics, all the states have positive, have Wigner functions that only take non-negative values, in which case you can, they can be thought of as a hidden variable model. So this is what motivates our definition of the classical theory for D-level systems with this sort of a discrete phase space. Here I have a 31 by 31 dimensional phase space. But so the next step is to find an epistemic restriction that would yield this hidden variable model. So here's a quote from this paper again. We have this guiding analogy for finding this, this principle. In quantum theory, a set of observables is jointly measurable if and only if it is commuting relative to the matrix commutator. So we can create the analogy, a set of variables is jointly knowable if and only if it is commuting relative to the Poisson bracket. So this was Rob's analogy for requiring this epistemic restriction that I'll describe here. So for these discrete, and this also works for continuous systems, but I'll just be focused on the discrete case. The knowable variables can only be linear combinations of position and momentum, and we call these quadrature variables. And the jointly knowable variables must commute via the Poisson bracket. So if we're looking at discrete systems, we need some definition of the Poisson bracket that works, that doesn't have a continuous derivative. So I'll just say that there is a reasonable discrete analog. And the value of this discrete Poisson bracket for two quadrature variables is equal to the symplectic inner product of these of the two variables. So here I've just written that out. The symplectic inner product can be understood as is equal to taking the transpose of one of these quadrature variables and then doing this matrix multiplication where J is equal to this anti-symmetric matrix. Okay, so the symplectic structure is important in constructing this principle for the epistemic restriction in this paper. And will be important later in the talk. So for the systems that we're going to consider, that we consider this, and Bill and I consider in our paper, we only need two-dimensional phase space, one momentum and one position, one momentum variable. And so Rob's work goes well beyond this, but we're just going to consider prime or prime power dimensional Hilbert spaces, and that's what allows us to have this restriction. And in that case, states of maximal knowledge, these epistemic states of maximal knowledge are uniform distributions over the lines. Okay, here again, we have this line that I've already shown. So why am I bothering with the symplectic stuff? it's important that the epistemic restriction be preserved by the dynamics. So you shouldn't be able to start with some epistemic state and then have it evolve in time into some other state where an observer or an agent has more information than should be allowed by the epistemic restriction. So affine symplectic transformations map the set of quadrature variables to itself. So these are the transformations that we're going to call the legal transformations in our epistemically restricted theory, because this will preserve the epistemic restriction. And so affine symplectic, these are just symplectic transformations followed by a displacement across the phase space. And right, so symplectic, you can just think of as meaning preserving area or volume, if that's unfamiliar. So from this section of the talk, I want the main messages you to take away from this are, for systems with single degree of freedom, the ontic states are given by a single position and momentum coordinate in phase space. The epistemic states are lines representing uniform probability distribution over certain ontic states, and the legal transformations are affine symplectic transformations. So how can we relate finite dimensional quantum systems to these sorts of structures? Now I'll move on to discrete phase space. So here we have, we're going to assume that our Hilbert space is some dimension D that is prime. Here we have a phase space corresponding to a seven-dimensional system. And we'll label these different points in the phase space with Greek letters alpha. And they have a position and they have a momentum coordinate, a Q and a P. And arithmetic in this space is performed modulo D.
Sorry, Billy, there's a question by Anna. You said,
oh, yeah.
I just in case you didn't notice. Like,
I did notice.
Feel free to
please interrupt
decide
me
if you want to answer.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer. I'm not really seeing updates from questions. So,
okay.
Anna, if you want to unmute yourself. Or...
Hi, I'm just going to use my friend's. Because my mic isn't working. Just to clarify, this idea of knowing exactly, being more explicit, if our dimension is, let's say, 2n, and knowing n questions, the answers to n questions, is this similar to essentially saying that you can have maximum n integrals of motion in involution, because otherwise your Poisson bracket would be degenerate?
They're kind of two different principles that were developed. As I understand it, the knowledge balance principle doesn't apply for like continuous systems. And this is why there's this other epistemic constraint based off the symplectic structure of the phase space that's introduced. And Rob, feel free to jump in if I'm saying something incorrectly. But so I just wanted to say, like, the knowledge balance principle, I just wanted to kind of tease that apart from this, what he calls the classical complementary principle, which is based off the phase space structure.
Okay, but you're not basing it on this.
I'm not basing it on I'm basing my, the epistemic constraint that I'm interested in is based off the symplectic structure of the phase space.
Okay.
And so the jointly knowable variables must commute. And in the case that I'm thinking of, this very simple case where you only have one position and momentum variable, that means you can only know one line.
Right.
Okay. I can maybe help. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, Anna, but if you're in a phase space, which is, you know, a ZD cross ZD, as we have here, you know, the reason you can only sort of know D variables is because at most D of those quadrature variables are going to commute relative to the Poisson bracket. That's sort of a feature of.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. Is that what you also first started off with? Why it's like half and half?
It's not where I started, but yeah, now I would say that's the best way of thinking about it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And Philippe, if I didn't just kind of barging ahead, please interrupt me if there are more questions. Okay, so here is our discrete phase space. So I wanted to say that arithmetic will be performed modulo D. So you can really think of these labels as Z mod DZ, and these form a field. This field structure is really important, but I won't discuss that too much. So phase point operators, this is a complete Hermitian operator basis indexed by phase space points. So we'll denote them with these A's, and here's their index, some phase space point alpha. And you can decompose some operators as a linear combination of these phase point operators. They're orthogonal relative to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, and they have a few key properties. Here's one that we'll focus on in this talk. The average of phase point operators along any line gives a projector onto a pure state. A complete set of parallel lines, or a striation as we refer to them, defines an orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space. And bases associated with different striations are mutually unbiased. And this mutually unbiased property just means that if you take the mod squared of the inner product of any two basis vectors from different bases, you get 1/D, the dimension of the space. So they're kind of balanced in a sense. So let me just sketch out how these properties apply for a qubit. And also, before I've been using points in an array to denote phase space points, sometimes I'll use a grid like this. So this is the phase point operator associated with the phase space point 0, 0. 0, 1 is up here. If you take the average of phase point operators along any line, you get this projector onto the spin up state in the Z direction, or on this line, you get the spin down state. And so we can also find projectors along any other set of parallel lines here. And of course, these are furnish an orthonormal basis. Discrete Wigner functions are the expansion coefficients for density matrices over phase point operators. So this is the equation I had before. Now this expansion coefficient is the Wigner function. We're gonna write Q for all of these quasi-probabilities. You see Q, you should think quasi-probability. And it has different values at points alpha and phase space, given some preparation rho. And using the orthogonality condition of these phase point operators, you can invert this equation and write the Wigner function in this way. So before I said the average of phase point operators along any line gives a projector onto a pure state, this means that discrete Wigner functions give marginal probability distributions that are correct. And this is important in this work, so we can do this little calculation. It's not so hard. We start with the Wigner function, and we're going to sum over all the points that correspond to this line. So just points alpha and lambda. This sum can be pulled into the trace, and we get an average over all points, over all the phase point operators in that line. And before we said, this gives a projector onto a pure state, which is this projector onto this ket 4. And so this gives us the probability of getting outcome 4 for some measurement that will associate with the horizontal axis, given that you prepared some quantum state rho. So you can play this game over all the different, there are D+1 different striations in this space, and you'll find legitimate probabilities that you get back. So what are the properties of the discrete Wigner function? They're real distributions on phase space. It's because the basis, the operators are Hermitian. They're normalized to 1. The sum over any line is a legitimate probability on a certain state that's associated with that line. So if we go back to the qubit, if I sum over the Wigner function on this line, that'll give me the probability of getting this plus Z state. But the Wigner functions can have negative values. That's why we call them quasi-probability distributions. They have all these good properties the normal probability distribution would have, save this last one. Here are a few examples of these discrete Wigner functions. We can have, for this zero ket, we can have a Wigner function like this that gives a line along the vertical direction. This eigenstate of the sigma x operator gives you a Wigner function with a line in this direction. The probability of getting the outcome is of giving this outcome given this state is given by summing these values. That's just going to be one, as we'd expect. But pure states need not all be represented as lines in the as Wigner functions. As you might expect, they're only a finite number of lines. So here's a pure state that has a Wigner function that looks like this. And I'll just point out that here's a value that's negative while the others are positive. Okay, so quasi-probabilistic quantum theory. So we've just talked about how Wigner functions represent preparations. We can also use constructions related to this to represent channels as transition quasi-probabilities. They take negative values. And there's also quasi-probability associated with a measurement outcome, E or POVM, a response quasi-probability, Q, which is the quasi-probability of getting some event E conditioned on phase-base point beta. And the interesting thing is that you can reproduce the predictions of the Born rule by using an equation that looks formally identical to what you would have in classical probability theory. You have some quasi-probability corresponding to your preparation. And this is how it transforms. And then this gives you your probability of some outcome E. Okay.
Billy, there was for a moment, I was a bit slow. There was a question by Charlie in the comments. I don't know if it now it disappeared. So Charlie, if you still have your question, you can ask it.
I think I was a little slow to raise my hand, honestly. I was just wondering, like, does the fact that we need a prime power mean we can't deal with, say, 2 qubits even, because it's going to be 2 to the n for n qubits?
So, if you said Q trits, we can deal with Q trits in what I'll be showing you. In particular, what I'm presenting actually doesn't work for a bunch of qubits, and that has to do with kind of a technical reason related to the number of symplectic matrices you get that we're calling legal for qubits. For odd primes, you can do prime powers and it all works out. For qubits, it doesn't work out quite so well.
Okay, thank you.
here's how we represent the channel using transition quasi-probabilities. Let's say we have some unitary that rotates a qubit by 90 degrees around the y-axis. It's going to have a transition quasi-probability representation, Q sub U, with different quasi-probabilities of starting in point alpha and going to point beta. And these, for this particular unitary transformation, are given by these quasi-probabilities. It's mostly 1/2, but there are some minus 1/2s sprinkled throughout here. So we could think about this as transforming this illegal Wigner function into another illegal Wigner function. So we start at point 0, 0, and we have a probability of 1/2 of going to every other point except 0, 1. And so that's shown here. Measurements. So here are a few examples of response quasi-probabilities, and they look very similar to the Wigner functions, but the normalization is different. And so these are, that's the main thing I wanted to say. The definition is almost exactly the same as for how you would, how would you represent a density matrix, but there's a factor of D that you have to multiply by in order to properly reproduce the quantum prediction given by the Born rule. So let's just do a quick example so we feel comfortable with using these. So I'm going to show how this equation works here. We have some preparation in the plus X, some state in the plus X direction. And that is represented as a line, horizontal line with probabilities 1/2 along that line. So in order to do this calculation, we can vectorize this phase space. And again, here we have the channel and the measurement I've already discussed. And here I'm representing the measurement as a row vector. And this actually kind of highlights the fact that these measurement quasi-probabilities live in the dual space. They map Wigner functions to numbers. And we put these all together in our calculation and do it out, you get 1/2, which is what you would expect if you start in the plus X direction, rotate 90 degrees and measure in that same basis again. So here's the probability of getting plus X given preparation plus X and unitary U. Okay, so now I'm moving on to our work. So classical frameworks and epistemically restricted states. What is the former and how does it relate to the latter? So again, in Rob's paper, I'll quote from it. He says, to specify an epistemic state, one must specify, one, the set of quadrature variables that are known to that agent, and two, the values of these variables. So in our work, what we say is for each component of an experiment, preparation, channel, measurement, outcome, we, one, choose a framework that imposes a certain form of the probability distribution, and two, construct a restricted probability distribution R that conforms to the framework applied to Q. Then this section will be working through what these two things mean. So each distribution R is a non-negative probability distribution, and the set of all R's for all possible frameworks contains the same information as Q, the quasi-probability. And the quasi-probability is going to be associated with preparation, channel, and measurement outcome. So one thing that I did want to mention, I guess this slide's fine, this Q, you have to interpret it based off the context. So this isn't one set conditional function. This one's just defined for preparations. This is for transformations, and this one for the measurements. Just wanted to make that clear. Okay, so let's look at how we choose a framework and construct these restricted probability distributions for states. So the framework choice is a striation. You have to choose a set of parallel lines, and that determines your framework for states. Then you get the R superscript B by averaging the Wigner function over each line. And I'll note that all other marginals will be uniform. So start with the Wigner function. Here's one that we've seen before. And we're going to choose the striation corresponding to the vertical lines. So that's infinite slope, we'll say. And we average over that line and we get 3/8, okay, or 3, ignoring the prefactor, and then assign that value to every point along the line. So now each point on this line is equiprobable. And we do the same thing for the other vertical line. So that gives us one of these R's. There are two others corresponding to the diagonal lines with slope 1. And then there's one where we add over just the rows. And so here we get the uniform distribution, and here we have some other legal probability distribution over the complete phase space. All these values are positive. So we've gone from something that holds all of the quantum information, all the information about this quantum state, and gone to three other objects. that have information about the three different marginal probabilities. Okay, and I saw a hand raise.
Hi, so I don't have a lot of experience with these discrete phase spaces, but I was wondering, like, if the analogy of a canonical transformation, like, what is the analogy of a canonical transformation here, and is it going to preserve these lines?
Yeah, great question. So the canonical transformations in classical mechanics preserve the symplectic structure. So those are the same as the symplectic transformations that I'm talking about here. So yeah, those are the same things. And so once we get to channels in the next couple of slides, we'll be talking about those. Great question. Okay, so here's how we constructed our R's from the Q, the Wigner function. So we can recover the Q from the R. So we actually haven't lost any information about our state. Here this is kind of the mindset one has when you do quantum tomography of states, channels, or measurements. You collect a bunch of marginal probability distributions, and you know that the joint quasi-probability distribution can be reconstructed. And this is a way to do that. So here we have what we call the non-random part of the probability of the quasi-probability distribution. And that just means take the uniform distribution, or start with the quasi-probability distribution and subtract off the uniform distribution from that. And that can be found to be equal to this sum over different choices of striation. So these three in this case are the qubit. Of the non-random part of the restricted probability distributions. And so, I mean, the difference between what we're doing and what one does in quantum state tomography is you start with a quantum state in state tomography, and then you look at the marginals. So here we're creating probability distributions all over the same probabilistic space, which is a difference. So it's like they're all over the same phase space. And they can be combined to give this Wigner function in this way. So now I'll move on to epistemically restricted channels. A framework choice in this case is a symplectic matrix. So these are the legal symplectic matrices for qubit. So I've listed three of them here. And I've used this word legal because there are other symplectic matrices in this case that that one could form that are, you know, 2 by 2, take entries 0 and 1. However, if you go from the phase space back to the Hilbert space for a qubit, those don't correspond to legal transformations. Those aren't unitary transformations. They have order 2, so they're reflections. Whereas these, there's the identity, but then also there's one we call R and L that have order 3. And they permute these points in phase space, clockwise or counterclockwise. So next we're gonna introduce this concept, displacement class associated with a symplectic matrix S. So you choose a symplectic matrix, and then different displacement classes are labeled with displacements delta. A displacement class is a set of pairs of points such that beta is equal to S alpha plus delta. So these are the pairs of points where the former is mapped to the latter, given some symplectic transformation, and then a displacement delta. So we can just see how that works here. So let's choose the simplest symplectic transformation, the identity matrix. Different colors correspond to different displacement classes. So let's just look at the displacement class labeled with 0, 0. What happens to the point alpha? Well, nothing happens to point alpha if you apply the identity operator to it and do nothing to displace it. And so that is encoded in these black boxes. Alpha 0, 0 goes to 0, 0, 0, 1 goes to 0, 1, 1, 0 goes to 1, 0, 1, 1 goes to 1, 1. in the red, we have displacements 0, 1 that just move you up, which is the same as down in this two-dimensional space. And so here we have this displacement class is given by these red boxes. So 0, 0 goes to 0, 1, goes up, 0, 1 goes to 0, 0, and so on. So that's what any set of four colors means. These are the four transformations compatible with this sort of affine symplectic transformation. And so this is the same thing for the symplectic transformation R and L. Right. So I'm going to create an analogy between states and channels. For states, we average quasi-probabilities over a line, and that set values at all the points of the line to that probability we got. And that's how we get our R's. For channels, we're going to average the transition quasi-probabilities corresponding to those of an affine symplectic transformation. So if these four are the non-zero transition probabilities for some affine symplectic transformation, we're going to average over those four. And then we're going to set the value at all the points in the displacement class to this probability we get. So let's do that for this transition quasi probability corresponding to this unitary rotation we looked at before. So here we're going to average this over the main diagonal, which is obviously going to be 1/2. So we're going to assign 1/2 to all these points, which we have there. Now, if we want to look at the red points, then we see we have equal number of plus and minus 1/2. So that's all going to be 0. And if you go through and do that for all these different displacement classes, you end up with these transition probability matrices that all have legal probabilities. And you could think of these as representing, as enacting different affine symplectic transformations with different probability. So like this is the probability of enacting the identity plus displacement of nothing with probability 1/2. And this is the identity with probably 1/2 of enacting some other displacement afterwards. Okay, so this has given us a way to go from transition quasi-probabilities to real probabilities. So in fact, we can play a similar trick to what we did before and recover these Q's from the R's in a very similar way, but now instead of summing over all the different striations, we need to sum over symplectic matrices. And so in fact, we haven't lost any information. We've done this sort of thing. But again, we have this, we have to take the non-random part. Rob, I see you've raised your hand.
I was just wondering, is it the case that if I think in terms of the analog of the Choi-Jamolkowski isomorphism, that these different symplectic matrices correspond to the different striations that you would have if you looked at the phase space for a pair of systems? Have I got that right?
I might have to ask you to restate your question, but I have been thinking about these, like I haven't quite made the connection in my mind, but it does seem very closely related to the Choi-Jamolkowski isomorphism, where it's like you can define, you have these transition, you have these symplectic transformations. You can also define them as choosing a striation to start with and a striation to end with.
I would have put it as not to start and to end, but if you think of your initial phase space and your final phase space as just a bigger phase space, so like it's isomorphic to the phase space for two systems of that type, So it's, you know, it started out as a two-dimensional, now you got a four-dimensional phase space. If you ask about striations of that phase space, it seems to me it does correspond to what you're talking about here.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if that is the case. Yeah. I should check that out. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. So now epistemically restricted measurements. This is very similar to the case of the states. Here we have a framework choice is again a striation. And we get these restricted probabilities of having some event E given some phase-based points beta by averaging the quasi-probabilities over each line again. How do you interpret this? If you take the marginals of this R, then you get the proper probability of getting event E, given that you prepared some state that corresponds to this line. But if you've prepared any other state that doesn't live in the striation, then you have no information. You're sampling the uniform distribution. So we form these R's for measurements in analogous way to states. And of course, we can recover using the same form, same equation that we used before. There's a little bit of a technical note. If how you define the delta in this case depends on the trace of the operator used for your POVM. But if you use projectors that correspond to lines in the phase space, then this delta can just mean uniform distribution. So from that, so we've explained how we can generate all these R's by starting with quasi probabilities. Then we can give the prediction of what we think of as an epistemically restricted observer living within a certain framework F that's given by B prime S and B. And their prediction is going to be given by this equation where you have some distribution over phase space for the preparation, transition probabilities, and measurement response function here. So this, to be clear, this is not the quantum mechanical probability. We restricted, this is a prediction subject to what you could think of as an epistemic restriction, but it is a reasonable number between 0 and 1. It's a probability, but it's usually a bad prediction, meaning that it's usually quite close to the uniform distribution. In fact, for most values that you choose for B prime S and B, this prediction is what you would expect if rho were the completely mixed state. If rho is the completely mixed state, you get the uniform distribution across phase space. And you could think of this as like you choose some striation and then you have uniform distribution across these lines, then you transform it somehow. If you measure in some striation that doesn't correspond to the one you started with, you're just going to be sampling the uniform distribution. So because of that, most of the terms will sum to 0 in our final equation with the deltas. And so to avoid that, you need to set B prime equal to the striation you get when transforming the initial one by some symplectic transformation. And we call this framework coherent in that case. Okay, so now I'll move on to how we reconstruct quantum theory from this collection of epistemically restricted theories. The question is, can we get quantum predictions by combining the non-random parts of classical predictions? And yes, we can. We can do it in this way. If we have what we call a minimal reconstructing set of symplectic matrices. And so this is a special set of d squared minus one symplectic matrices, such that the difference between any two of them has non-zero determinant. This allows us to sum over all these different symplectic transformations and get back from the R's to the Q. And we know that such a set exists in only these prime dimensions. We don't know whether such a set exists for any other dimension. So here's a paper that proves this, that this does exist in these dimensions, but cannot do it for any higher dimensions. For any prime, or for any odd prime, and we can generalize to odd prime powers, if we don't just use this special set, but all symplectic matrices, then we can get this non-random part of the quantum prediction back. But we have to introduce a redundancy when we use all symplectic matrices. And the way you can think about, when we're looking at the R's corresponding to states, we have this way of combining all of them to get back to the Wigner function. That relies on the special property that if you choose a point in phase space and you look at all lines through that point in phase space, that point itself will appear on a line corresponding to the number of lines you used. Okay, so that's d plus one. But every other point in phase space will appear on a line just once. And so there's a similar thing that happens when you have symplectic matrices such that the difference between any of them is non-zero determinant. If you take any two non-zero points in phase space, there will only be one symplectic matrix that takes your first point to the second point if you have a set with this property. So if then you use all symplectic matrices, there are then going to be D matrices that take your initial point to your final point, as long as they're both non-zero. So that's where this factor comes from. So we have this general equation that we can write by introducing this, by introducing a script Z that stands for one, we have a minimal reconstructing set, and D when we use all the symplectic matrices. Is it surprising that we get the quantum prediction back by combining all these, what we're thinking of as epistemically restricted predictions? Not really, because what we did is we started with quantum theory, right? We had a Wigner function, we took the marginals, we got these things, and now we're saying, oh, we can just go back. So I guess the one interesting thing is that on the right-hand side here, you know, this is what we got by doing everything in the epistemically restricted space and then take the non-random part. So that's kind of interesting that, you know, it kind of like, you can package it up in this way. But really, like what we did is we started with quantum theory. So any constraints that made sets of R's correspond to legal quantum states were already enforced by starting with Wigner functions, legal Wigner functions. In order to start with just R's or the epistemically restricted probabilities, we need constraints that enforce this global legality or some global constraints of the various probability distributions. You could imagine starting with a bunch of R's that don't correspond to a legal Wigner function because they localize your system in some point in phase space, which would not correspond to a legal quantum state. So what does this all mean? This mathematical method of combination does not connect with common notions of probability theory. that I'm aware of. I mean, I'd love someone to say, oh, like here's where you want to use, you know, non-random or non-uniform parts and combine them all. This is where you use that in probability theory, but I'm not aware of that. And so there's no obvious state of affairs or ontology that presents itself. So to bridge this gap between epistemically restricted theories and full quantum theory, one is forced to make this mathematical step that does not easily fit into a principled framework. And to be clear, this does not imply that an epistemic interpretation of quantum state must be abandoned. We've just looked at one specific approach. And so some future research directions I'm interested in. I'd like to dig a little deeper on the global constraints for the R's and find something that looks like a more native approach in the epistemically restricted land where these R's live. One way to come up with a global constraint in the R's is say, take your R's, form a Wigner function. Does that Wigner function correspond to a legal density matrix? But that's not so satisfying. So it's been hard to come up with a intuitive global constraint in the R's. I'm interested in working to extending this to composite numbers. People who study quantum Bayesianism, cubism, have interesting ways of combining legal probability distributions to get quantum predictions, and I'm interested in learning more about that. I'm interested in seeing if there's a way that understanding how contextuality is restored in this way of combining probabilities. And I'm also interested in exploring connections with decoherence. So in conclusion, epistemically restricted classical theories present a compelling argument for an epistemic interpretation of the quantum state. One way to reach full quantum theory from such classical theories requires a simple yet unusual combination of classical predictions. And this can be thought of as one way in which quantum theory requires us to go beyond classical probability theory. So here's an archive link to our preprint, and I want to thank you all for your attention.
Thanks a lot for the very nice talk. So we have plenty of time for questions. So I guess you can raise your hand and I will just tell you to speak in order that they appear. So Rob, you can go.
Hello, you mean me?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, hi. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so I thought it was a very interesting talk. I have a couple of questions. Unless I missed something, the epistemic restrictions you impose in the thing you're using are basically all straight lines, effectively. Is that right? Of these prime spaces, is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
So, are there any other possible restrictions one could use, doing something different than lines?
Well, if you have, if you aren't just looking at a space where a single position and momentum coordinate defines your ontic state, then you can get some things more interesting than the maximal. You can have epistemic states that, so say you had a system with two position degrees of freedom, and so two momentum degrees of freedom. So the phase space is four dimensional. You could have an epistemic state where the position is known for one of your degrees of freedom, and you have no information about the momentum, but you might have no information about the position or momentum of the second degree of freedom. So then it looks like you're going to have like a hyperplane in that space.
Okay, but it's still in some sense a variant of what you're doing, right? I guess what I'm thinking of is something that maybe is a weaker epistemic restriction that gets you to some model, albeit a toy model or theory, that's in between classical and quantum physics, right? I mean, what you get with this restriction plus the prescription is something that looks a lot like quantum physics. So I'm wondering what flexibility, if any, there is for turning the knobs on the epistemic restriction that could get you in between.
Yeah, I don't.
Maybe there isn't. Maybe it's all either this or not. But I just wonder. That's the thrust of the question.
I know Rob can answer this one, but as I remember from his work, I think the extra like knob you can tune when you have continuous systems is like there is something that lives between these epistemically restricted theories and quantum theory, because you can enact squeezing transformations. But
it has to be a continuous system, is that right?
Yeah, I don't. So I'll let Rob correct me, but I don't think there is anything that can live between the epistemically restricted theory and quantum for discrete systems.
Yeah, if you want to add to that, which is Rob.
Can you comment, Rob, on?
Yeah, like if I take qubits and I look at the Clifford subgroup of the full unitary group on n qubits, so that's the set of transformations that keep you inside the set of joint eigenstates of products of polys, the stabilizer formula. So what you can easily show is that if you add any other unitary to the Clifford group and you close under group operations, you get back to the full unitary group. And so that, I mean, maybe that's not a full explanation, but if you ask, for example, in the space of transformations, you know, why isn't it that why can't I find some halfway house between the Clifford transformations and the full set of unitaries? The answer is group theory tells you that there's no such thing. There is no group that is a subgroup of the full unitary group and is larger than and subsumes the Clifford group.
Right. And so in the classical case, as I was saying, you can enact these squeezing transformations, which don't give you the full unitary group. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Yeah. Okay. And ask one other thing. Please. Have this discrete Wigner function that can be negative. So in this context, what's the interpretation of the negativity of the discrete Wigner function? Or have you given that much thought?
I haven't given it a ton of thought, but I guess I go back to this. So Richard Feynman also thought about like things that could look like discrete Wigner functions. And I can't remember exactly, maybe his paper was in the 70s. And he's grappling with what negative probability means. And so he's comparing negative probability to negative apples. So we talk about like negative apples or negative dollars all the time. And that's not something that we go out and we find in our physical world, but we ascribe some meaning to it. It means that I owe you some apples. And we have to account for that negativity by combining it with some other things that actually exist in our reality, some positive apples. So in similar with probabilities, if you have some negative probability, that only, or quasi-probability, that only has some meaning when you end up looking at a marginal distribution. Those are the things we can actually access in our world. I haven't thought about it a ton, but I think that's one way to...
Because I'm kind of wondering, there are notions that the negativity of a Wigner function, like the kind I'm used to, there are notions that the negativity of a Wigner function is connected to the non-classicality. A positive Wigner function is effectively classical, but if it's got negativity, then it's not as classical. And I mean, it seems to me there should be some analog for this discrete thing, and that's what I was wondering. But
yeah, so I mean, Rob has written a paper that connects contextuality with negativity or non-contextuality with non-negative Wigner functions, and shows that those are the same thing. So that's for the discrete things.
Okay.
Or for I think maybe it's more general than that.
Yeah. All right. Okay. But it's still, I mean, I sort of gather that more thought could be given to this. Am I right or not?
Yeah, I definitely can. Haven't thought so much about this particular, the interpretational aspects.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob?
This is part of the question period where the Robs get to ask questions. first of all, Billy, thanks. That was a really clear presentation. So thanks for putting a lot of effort into making this understandable. I think I got a little bit lost when you were sort of showing how you could reproduce the quantum predictions using a sum of these R functions. So I got that, but then I kind of lost the plot on how that connects to epistemically restricted classical theories. So those different R's for different striations, do you have some sense in which they're, like, you want to interpret them as is it just that they represent states and effects that could be given a positive Wigner representation and therefore could be understood in this epistemically restricted way? Is that
the idea? Yeah, I mean, yeah, they not just can, but they do have a positive representation. They always do. And so, yeah, we're interpreting them as the epistemic states that an observer can have subject to a particular framework that we define by these symplectic matrices and striations.
Can you go back to the slide where you were taking the average along the different striations and getting these different R, let's say for the states? Yeah, here. So yeah, here, yes. So if I look at that first, say the infinite slope striation, that one of the vertical lines. So you have this RB of, you know, 3/8, 1/8, 3/8, 1/8.
Mm-hmm.
Idea is that if I take the difference between like that if I subtract off the uniform guy, which is a quarter, 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 I don't get a state that is positive everywhere. So I'm trying to make the connection between this and the some epistemically restricted classical theory.
So these R's, these distributions are what we think of as the restricted, epistemically restricted distributions or states that an observer can have. So in this case, we marginalized over the vertical lines, and in our paper, we kind of have this intermediate step before the Q's and the R's, where we define another distribution, which are the marginal distribution, the P's. So those are legal probability distributions just corresponding to the marginal values.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, okay, this observer has an epistemic restriction, so they can only know the marginal values along for one set of striations. And then once they gain that information, their best explanation of what's happening over the set of optic states is by ascribing equal probability to everything along the line. So it's like you sum up this vertical line, you get 3/4, and then you say, okay, I know there's 3/4 probability to be found in this line, but I have no information in any other striation. So I should just assign equal probability to all of them, and I get 3/8.
Okay, so these different
It's like their best explanation of what's going on in this ontic world based off the information they can gather due to their epistemic restriction.
Okay. So I think, though, you've made me understand that, like, the kinds of valid probability distributions relative to the sort of epistemic restriction you're imagining do not map on to the ones that occur in, you know, representations of the stabilizer formalism. Like, they're, you know, in that case, there's nothing like 3/8, 3/8, an eighth, an eighth.
Mm-hmm.
So your chemically restricted states are a wider set than in these other theories.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like a probabilistic combination of those.
Okay, maybe that's the part I don't get. It's a probabilistic combination of those.
And well, I think,
how do I find the probabilities?
In the stabilizer formalism, like, you would just have a single line, I believe.
Right.
And so all I mean is, like, this one has probability of 3/4 of for this stabilizer state and 1/4 for this corresponding to this line.
Right. Okay. So yeah, you're just having, yeah, good. Yeah, mixtures of the mm-hmm. valid epistemic states from those theories, but mixtures where the probabilities are allowed to be anything, not restricted to, you know, a half or whatever. So that's the sense in which you sort of go beyond the ones that were allowed before.
And okay, I think you also mentioned, like, negativity, or like why we use this delta in our equation. I can expand a little bit on that too. I mean, that's just necessary to get the proper quasi-probability. If you start with all these epistemically restricted states, I wish I had, like, a chalkboard. I can write down the equation and show you that, like, that's the way it works out. But
yeah.
I mean, another way to maybe motivate that is, we know Wigner functions can have negativity. It's interesting that, like, that's the way, by subtracting off the uniform distribution, you're going to get some parts of your normal probability distribution then will have some negativity to them. So it's like you can kind of step away from the uniform distribution down and up by doing the sum over the different delta of the different delta R's.
If I can ask another question, it's kind of related to what you're saying. Let's forget about transformations for the moment and just imagine you have a pair of measure scenarios. It makes everything a little bit easier. Then what you called the coherent frameworks, in that case, would just be the case where the striation for the preparation matches the striation for the measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you said later that you recover the quantum predictions by summing over the frameworks, you really mean summing over all the coherent frameworks. Is that right?
Like, yes. Yeah, okay. Good question. So let's just, again, look at our friendly R state here. So let's say we chose, again, the vertical striation. And for our preparation, and then for the measurement, we chose the horizontal one. In that case, you're going to be summing this. You're going to get 1/2 and 1/2. So you get the uniform distribution.
Yeah.
And this isn't just a coincidence. This is what happens every time, because you're effectively mm-hmm. sampling one value from each of these lines. And the probability is normalized to 1, but then each of these values is 1/d of the marginal. So anyways, yeah, you're always going to get the uniform distribution. So then when you take the difference between your R and the uniform distribution, you're going to get 0. So summing over the coherent frameworks doesn't mean that you're going from not getting the correct answer.
Number for Monday's meeting, ?
Oh, someone's talking. So summing over the coherent frameworks doesn't mean that now you're getting the right answer. It just means that now you're not summing a bunch of things that equal 0.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So then this is my attempt to kind of summarize for the case of qubits, the sort of mathematical trick here. And tell me if this is a valid summary or not. Like if I wanted to evaluate just trace of some effect E times some density operator rho, mm-hmm. I could do it as follows. Notice that the projector onto Z up, the projector onto Z down, the projector onto X up, X down, Y up, Y down, those six projectors form a basis for the operator space. And so I could rewrite rho as a sum of them. Similarly with the effect E, I could rewrite it as a sum of those operators. And now when I take that inner product, the only places where I get something interesting is where mm-hmm. The same basis meets each other, because all the others are going to give uniform distributions. Mm-hmm. And so I can sort of, if I forget all the uniform stuff, then I just have, the Z parts of the effect and the Z parts of the state meeting, similarly with the X parts and the Y parts. Mm-hmm. And somehow by taking the difference with subtracting off the uniform stuff means I can take the sum with just the positive coefficients. If you do it the way I just described, like some of those coefficients will be negative. So yeah, it feels a little bit like the quasi probabilities have moved into sort of the mixture over these different terms, like these different striations.
What do you mean they moved into them?
Well, okay. So I guess what I'm saying is if you hadn't subtracted off the uniform stuff,
mm-hmm.
If you said, look, let's just express if you had just tried to do it in terms of the R's themselves rather than the delta R's, mm-hmm. I think you could have recovered the quantum predictions by allowing a linear combination of those different R's where some of the coefficients could go negative. And so that's the sense in which I cannot think of it as just an average, for example. Just being like you cannot interpret the whole thing as, look, it's one of these and I don't know which, so I average and mm-hmm. now I get the quantum predictions,
right?
And so there's some, it feels like there's some negativity if I try to write it out as a mixture, but if I do this trick of subtracting off the uniform stuff, I can kind of eliminate all the negativity from those coefficients.
Yeah, that I have to like write it down and like kind of see it, but I think I'm following along with what you're saying, and I totally believe it. Like there's no way you can average a bunch of probabilities and get something that has any negativity, which you need in the Wigner function. In general, I mean. So, yeah, I don't have like I can't say, yes, this is exactly how it works out, but yeah, I think I see what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting. Thank you.
I would have a question also. I think it's related to what Rob just asked. Like as you were talking, I was reminded of this cubism stuff with the sick POVMs and okay, at the end you talked about it, and I don't remember exactly how it works, but it's like you can express quantum predictions as some kind of average of fictional measurements of sick POVMs, and then, but it's not the average, it's the average and then you subtract something, right? So it seems mm-hmm. to be I'm not sure exactly what I'm asking, but is there some connections made here with also what Rob was asking?
I'm sure there are some connections. I'm not sure exactly what they are. And like, as I said, that's kind of like on my list of things to do is to understand if they're like how that connects with the equation that shows up in the theory that's used in cubism. I haven't studied that in depth. So, but I gave a, yeah, I've talked about this like in briefly with someone who's spent a lot of their PhD work thinking about it. And I'm hoping that we can draw some connections.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Who are you talking to of the cubists?
I just talked to John De Broda.
Right.
It was a postdoc, and well, he did his PhD with Chris Books. But when we finished the draft of this paper, Bill was keen to send it to Chris. So I'm not sure if Chris has read it, but.
Okay, so then if there's no other questions, I think we should thank Billy again. It was very nice talk. I enjoyed a lot.
Thanks for having me. So,